I'll leave a couple of these other things for afterward, and we'll get into where do we go from here. I imagine that for some of you that have been walking with folks at the Bridge for any amount of time, for any season, that now Pastor Tim is gone, we're in a different building, like things are maybe radically different than you expected, that your world is a little shaken up. And I get that. I've lived in that world a little bit. I remember when I left my first stable ministry to go plant a church, and it was just me and my wife and some friends that lived 45 minutes away that were sort of well-wishers. I remember feeling like, where is God in all of this? And my world just feels kind of shaken up and loose. And then once we get that church plant stable and it's running and we've got pastors and I've got assistants and we're just kind of running on full gears, the Lord kind of compelled in my heart, he stirred me up to, hey, now it's time to leave and start all over again. And so I kind of know from experience that feeling of like your world has just been shaken up a little bit. And the disciples felt the same thing, because Jesus is coming and he's preaching this message that the king has come. God has come to be among his people, that he's ready to set the world right again. And he gathers these crowds and this following and people that leave their jobs and they say, I'm following you. And they bank everything on the fact that this one man is the God King who's coming to fix everything. And before they know it, after 3 years of starting to conquer the world, he's captured and he's arrested and he's tortured and he's brutally murdered. And their world was shaken up. And then the good news, 3 days later, he's alive again. And their world is shaken up even more. And then they're like, okay, is this the time? Is this the time? What's going to happen next? And so that's kind of where I want to bring you. The disciples know very much where what you're feeling, what you're going through. I've had a taste of it. And this is kind of just where we are right now. What's next? Where are we going? And so I thought it was very providential that this week, which is Pentecost Sunday, the day that we celebrate the Spirit being poured out on his church, is the day where we open a new chapter in this book. And so if you have a Bible, I'm going to be in the book of Acts, chapter 1. We are going to talk a little bit about Pentecost. I'll give you a minute to find it. Acts, chapter 1. Now, initially, Pentecost was not something that was celebrated in the world culture. Pentecost was a celebration for a specific people called the Jews or the Hebrews. And what they're celebrating is that 50 days after God gives them the Passover, which is basically God rescuing his people out of slavery, he gives them the law. Right? He gives them, these are the rules that you are to follow because you are my people. And so it was, Pentecost is tied up into the word 50, right? If you know Pentagon, Pentecost, it was a 50th day of celebration after they were rescued, right, from Egypt. These people that were slaves, they're rescued out of Egypt. God says, with a mighty arm and an outstretched hand, I rescued you, I made you my people. And then 50 days after that, I'm giving you a law. And so every year they would commemorate with a celebration they called Pentecost. And it was a celebration that God gave his people a law. Right? And it's very, very fitting that in the Old Testament, the gospel story was God rescued his people from slavery. The New Testament story with Jesus is that God rescues his people from slavery. And so in the Old Testament, it was, here's the way you're supposed to live. In the New Testament, it becomes, here's the power you're supposed to take to live by it. And so it becomes a very, very beautiful one-for-one picture. But before this happens, here's what Jesus does. I'm in Acts chapter 1 in verse 4. Jesus is giving his disciples instruction preceding this Spirit being poured out on them so they can actually do the things that God wants them to do. Verse 4, and while staying with them, he ordered them not to depart from Jerusalem, but to wait for the promise of the Father, which he said, you heard from me, for John baptized with water, but you will be baptized with the Holy Spirit not many days from now. This is going to be very quick. Okay, I want to kind of hit you with the point of this text, and then I want to spend the rest of the time just unpacking what it's going to look like. Okay? The first thing Jesus says, wait for the promise of the Father. This is a command and a thing that God holds out for his people on a constant, almost everyday basis. Wait. Wait. We build up anticipation. We build up eagerness. We want to see God move. We want to see lives transformed. We want to see the church explode. We want to make things happen. We get really excited, just like the disciples were. And God comes in and says, wait. Just wait. Wait for the promise of the Father that you heard from me. And we go about life and we're praying about things and we're fasting about things and we're like, God, this is the direction you've given me, right? And I mean, I look at this very, very personally and I say, God, you pulled me from a stable ministry and you allowed me to plant another stable church in a city that did not love you. And now that city has the gospel. And I was finally like, I was making a name for myself. I was being invited to speak at college campuses and at chapel things. And I was being invited with my network to speak at national conferences. And we were hosting regional conferences and things were happening. And now you've said, I want you to leave this and go start something else. And I can't promise. I didn't get the promise from God that it would be anything like what I experienced in Asheville. It was just go. People need to hear the truth. And you need to be the one to go. And now in hindsight, I'm looking and things are happening. But, you know, I showed up in Cincinnati and I wanted things to happen. Right? I wanted my friends to come to Jesus. I wanted my family that doesn't walk with him. I wanted them to know who he was and have their lives changed by him. I wanted to see the church like within a year just explode. I wanted to fall deeply in love with the people that I was ministering to. And all along, God just keeps saying, wait, just wait, just wait. It's not going to happen on your time. It's not going to happen on your time. The action of faithful waiting is one of the hardest things for people to endure. Isn't it? When you get news about an illness and you don't know what it is, that's a little taste of hell, isn't it? I just want to know. I want to know what it is. That anticipation can just eat your lunch. Because waiting is incredibly hard. Waiting feels unnatural. It makes us feel powerless. And often it feels like a total waste of time. And so I know where you guys are coming from. Because I come from the same place. We are generally not a people who endure waiting faithfully. That's not the way we roll. It's not the way we're wired. It's not the way we operate. We don't wait faithfully. Now, some of us will say, yeah, but I wait. And I'm always waiting. I wait and I do it faithfully. But here's the deal. Some of us, when we wait, especially with a religious perspective, we wait with this idea that God owes us something because we've waited. Right? And so let's just take my story again. I'll beat myself up a little bit here. Right? I show up in Cincinnati. I want to see things happen. And God has promised he wants to see the portions of this city, if not people, specific people that I felt burdened to come to reach. He wants to see them transformed. And so we jump in and we say, yes, I'll wait. I'll wait as long as I know you're going to do this. And so it's not really faithful waiting. It's really just kind of waiting God out and try to manipulate him. If I wait long enough, then God has to come through. He owes me. Why? Because I've waited. I've done my part. And so now God owes me. And so some of you, that's your posture in waiting. I will do this so that God will bless me. We wait and we believe that God owes us something for our waiting. Usually it's what we've been waiting for. And it's not faithful waiting. It shows what's really on your heart, what you really want. And what you really want isn't more of God, more of his grace, more of his personal presence, which is what Pentecost is all about, the pouring out of the personal presence of God. We don't want that. We just want the power. We want the toys. If we can get the toys without the God, thank you, we'll have that. Right? And we show that in the way that we wait. Many of us wait because we just want the toys. And God's saying, but I'm better than the toys. The toys will leave you empty. The toys will leave you unsatisfied. But I will never, never leave you unsatisfied. So wait. Now, others of us, we don't have that kind of patience, right? And so some of you are like, yep, I know I don't wait, right? It's not an I'll wait, but give me what I want. It's I just don't even want to wait. I have to get on with life. And I had a huge taste of this. When we moved from Easley, South Carolina, which many of you have probably never heard of, that's okay. We moved to Asheville, North Carolina, which many of you have probably never heard of. That's not okay. We're going to talk a lot about Asheville. It's a cool little town. But I remember when we were moving in, this was before the big economic crash, and we had sold our house in South Carolina, and I was adamant that we move into a house right away. Now, if you know anything about like the housing market in 06, it was way inflated. And Asheville is a city that the prices are inflated anyway. And so for a little 700 square foot house, we paid an astronomical amount of money, right? Way too much money, to the point where we actually still own the property. And thankfully, God has blessed us and we've been able to rent it and get into a house up here. But because I wouldn't wait, I had to have a house. It had to be within this time frame that I set up. Hey, I'm going up there next weekend. We're finding a house. It wasn't prayed through. It wasn't, I didn't have a lot of wise counselors in helping me with it. It was just, I don't want to waste my money on rent, so I'm buying a house and this is the one. And because of that, it's still sort of an anchor, not just for my way of living, but kind of for my soul. It's a burden that I carry because it's a couple hundred miles away, and if anything happens to it, I'm the one that's responsible for having to repair that. That's kind of a burden for me. And so a lot of us, we find ourselves in those places where we just don't wait and we make foolish decisions. Right? We don't wait for the things that God has promised. We have to get on with it. And so the problem with us is that rarely do we wait for the personal presence of God. But here's the good news. Because all of us can walk through life and say, yep, here's where I don't wait, here's where I don't wait, here's where I wait, but it's only, all right, I'll wait as long as you give me what I really want. The good news is that Jesus waited. When you read through the scriptures, you read the first story of the Bible where God creates man and woman, and he puts them in a garden, and he says, I want my personal presence to dwell with you there. Here's what I'd like for you to do so you can represent me, so that when I'm not ever present, my image is there. They took it and they wadded it up, and they threw it in the trash, and they spit on it, and they said, no, thank you, we don't want it. So what does God do? He waits. I mean, he provides provision, yes, but he waits, and he waits, and he waits, and he creates a people, and he calls out one man, Abraham, and he says, I'm going to bless you. But Abraham was 100 years old before he had a kid. Abraham had to wait. And then he raises of his children tribes, and he promises to the tribes a land, but they don't ever see it. And then they're in slavery, and they're rescued out of that slavery. And God says, through Moses, I'm going to take you to the land that I've promised. And they kind of complain about it doesn't happen fast enough. And so what happens? They wait. And they go on a 40-year camping trip. And none of them get to go into the land, right? And then he raises up a kingdom, and he promises that I'm going to fix the whole world through this kingdom. And what happens? The people have to wait, and they have to wait, and they have to wait. And he builds a temple, and the temple gets destroyed because they're not faithful. And there's all this waiting, and there's all this unfaithfulness, and there's all this stuff. And the biggest problem is that people don't want to wait. And Jesus waits. And then finally, he breaks in on the scene. And he comes, and he lives among us. And he lives the life that we should have lived. And he waits. He's patient. He waits 30 years to even reveal who he is. For 30 years, he's swinging a hammer. He's just an average blue-collar guy. He's getting blisters in his hands, and he's waiting. He's getting wronged by people all around. And at some point, probably, what history and tradition tells us is that his mother, Mary, who's married to his adopted father Joseph, at some point Joseph dies because he's not in the picture when Jesus has his public ministry. He's gone. And I think Jesus loved his dad. He worked with him. How do you not love the dad that you work with? especially if you're Jesus. And I know Jesus wants so badly to do something about it. And he waits. And then you see the story of Lazarus, one of Jesus' closest friends. He dies, and Jesus gets word. Your friend Lazarus, the one whom you love, he's dead. What does Jesus do? He waits to even go visit. And he shows up, and it wasn't out of lack of love, because when he shows up, man, he weeps so much that his enemies look at him and says, wow, this guy really loved him. But he waits, and he waits, and he waits. And as he's being tortured and murdered, and he knows what's going to happen, he waits, and he endures. And so the good news is that even though we don't wait, we have a Savior that waits well in our behalf. And so what we want is we want union to him. We want to wait like Jesus waited. We want his Spirit to be poured out on us so that we have the personal presence of God. Because of his waiting, we can wait. And we can have it. And if we did it, it would change everything about our lives. Here's what will happen when we wait like Jesus waited, when we're in union with him, when we wait faithfully. Verse 6. So when they had come together, they asked him, Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? See, they're excited. They're anticipating something big. He says to them, it's not for you to know times or seasons that the Father has fixed by his own authority. But you will receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you. And you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the end of the earth. And when he had said these things, as they were looking on, he was lifted up and a cloud took him out of their sight. And while they were gazing into heaven as he went, behold, two men stood by them in white robes and said, Men of Galilee, why do you stand looking into heaven? This Jesus who was taken up from you into heaven will come in the same way as you saw him go into heaven. Jesus promises when we wait, if we wait in union with him, if we wait in the Spirit that he waited in, that we will receive power. We will receive power. And the other thing, we will be his witnesses. This angel, I think it's a fascinating question. Why do you stand looking into heaven? It's almost like the angel's coming to them and saying, what did Jesus tell you to do? He told you to wait. Why are you looking? Why are you still anticipating? Is he coming back now? Like, they're standing, looking into heaven, waiting. All right, is it now? Is it now? Like, right away, they're told, wait. They see this amazing thing. They see Jesus, who was crucified, murdered, and then alive again. He ascends in front of them into heaven. And he's told them, wait. And what do? They don't want to wait. Standing there looking. Okay, we're waiting. Come on back now. They don't wait. But if we will wait, we have this promise. You will receive power and you will be my witnesses. So then they develop a new pattern. They develop a new pattern for living. Verse 12. So they're told, stop standing there gazing into heaven. Wait. What do? Verse 12. Then they return to Jerusalem from the mount called Olivet, which is near Jerusalem, a Sabbath day's journey away. And when they had entered, they went up to the upper room where they were staying. Peter and John and James and Andrew, Philip and Thomas, Bartholomew and Matthew, James the son of Alphaeus, and Simon the Zealot, and Judas the son of James. All these, with one accord, were devoting themselves to prayer together with the women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and his brothers. So what's the pattern? They wait. How do they wait? Number one, they spend time together. They don't wait in isolation. Jesus didn't say, go away by yourself and wait. And so what do the disciples do? They get together. They go back to Jerusalem. They go back to this upper room where they're staying, and they wait together. And that's one of the things that we as a church are going to start doing. We're going to wait together. I believe that God has amazing things in store for what he's going to do through this body of believers. I think he's going to take the gospel and he's going to impact lives of people that you know. And this city is going to be a different city because of our interaction with it. We need to wait for that. and we need to do it together. And so one of the things we're going to do is we're going to get together. We're going to spend time together. And so over the summer, like I said, for Missio, it's ramping up. For the bridge, it seems like it's going to slow down. But the goal in that is that we spend time together so that we can do the second thing that happens. They know one another, right? They're personal friends. Why else would you include everybody's name here? Like, what significance really is that? What transforming effect does it have that you know it's Bartholomew instead of Eddie? The point that the author is trying to make here is these are people that are known. These are people that are personal friends. Hey, these are the guys. Look at how close they are. Look at how tight they are. They become personal friends. They get to know one another. And so this summer, that's what I anticipate doing. I want to see a lot of interaction. I want to see a lot of stories being shared. I want to see you guys just love and bless the Conrads so that their new baby feels loved by the people of God. And I know a lot of you guys want to do that. I mean, that's one of our biggest things in life is we want to know and we want to be known. We want to hear and we want to be heard. And that's what we want to create. That's the kind of community I believe that Jesus wants for his people. And I think that's the kind of community that they got to create while they're waiting. And in the waiting, some of the amazing life-transforming stuff happens. So they get together, they get to know one another. They share their stories, they share their character. What else? They're one in purpose. All these with one accord. I mean, they're united. What's our purpose? We want to see the transformation of people's lives. We want to see people introduced to the reality that Jesus Christ is alive, that he pours out his spirit on people who call out to him, that no heart is hardened beyond the reach of the Holy Spirit. That's what we want to be purposefully united about. How do we do it? Man, who cares? Let's be united about that one purpose. We want to see people transformed. It's going to go out in all kinds of different ways. And then one of the things that we cannot miss, they prayed together. So they got together. They knew one another. They had a similar purpose, and they prayed it out. And I want us to learn what it really means to pray. Because here's the thing. The Christian faith, it's really not hard, is it? Love God and love people. The concept is really, it's easy enough for my 7, 4, and 3-year-old to get. Love God, love people. The problem isn't in lack of information. The problem is our hearts aren't bent to do that. So what do? We pray it in. And what do? We help have others involved in our lives that pray that out with us. And so we confess things that are going on in our hearts. Man, I don't love God in this area of my life. Would you pray for me? Or, hey, you don't seem to be loving God in this area of your life. Can I pray for you? Can we pray together, not just individually? Prayer is often a group event, and it's not just, hey, my great Aunt Thelma has thyroid cancer, and we need to pray for her healing. We need to do that. Like, don't get me wrong. We need to do that because that's part of the story. But, man, we need to get deeper than that. We know what's going on. All right, how are you dealing with your trust in God because your Aunt Thelma has thyroid cancer? And if you have an Aunt Thelma with thyroid cancer, I didn't, like, eavesdrop on emails or anything like that. It's purely coincidental. And so we'll pray for your Aunt Thelma, okay? But, oh, man, we need to know what's going on in the hearts of people and what would it look like, man, if we got together and we knew one another and we were acquainted with one another's stories and we've got one purpose to see Jesus magnified in our lives and we're praying that out as a community. That would be intense. And that's the building of the kingdom of God. And is it going to happen like in one fell swoop? Well, one day it will. But until then, we wait. We wait like Jesus waited. We grab a hold of him. We find ourselves in union with him. And so if we're going to do this, let me tell you a few things about me and then how this is going to get unpacked. I did not come to Jesus until I was 18 years old. I did not grow up in the church. I did not grow up hearing the gospel, at least not that I'm aware of. I was born to a teenage mother who I already had an older sister. And so my mom, by the time she was 21, already had the 3 kids that she was going to have. My parents had sort of a shotgun wedding, right? Where it was, oh, mom's pregnant, so dad has to marry her now. And so it was not a great marriage. It wasn't even a good marriage. And that's the world I grew up in. Mom tried to do the best that she could. And so she would take me to the Roman Catholic Church in our neighborhood because my family has that in their background, even though none of them are very practicing Roman Catholics. And so as far as I knew, I never heard the gospel. All I ever heard about God is that I've got to be more moral. I've got to behave better or else he's going to thump me. So I couldn't smoke weed. I couldn't smoke cigarettes. I couldn't drink beer. If I did those things, then God would hate me. And I didn't want God to hate me, but I also didn't want to stop doing those things. And so rather than like live in that world, I created a new message, which was there is no God, which is what kind of we all do, right? That can't be God, and I knew it. And after my senior year in high school, one of my buddies during my senior year, he was kind of a jerk, but he was a cool guy to go rock climbing with. He heard the message of Jesus, and it changed his life, and he stopped being a jerk. And I watched this guy, like, I watched his heart just change. And it wasn't like an overnight radical, like he was a drug abuser, and then he wasn't. That wasn't his story. It was slow. But I noticed the change. And so that summer after my senior year, we started hanging out a little more. We were climbing a lot together. We happened to work at the same place. And so these people that had befriended him and told him about Jesus, they sunk their claws into me. And this small community of people that loved Jesus loved me. And they told me about Jesus, and they told me about forgiveness, and they told me that it's not you that cleans up your life, it's Jesus that cleans up your life. And he'll deal with you on all these things that you have struggles with. And that changed me. I mean, it shaped me. I couldn't shake this idea that Jesus wanted to walk with me, that the God who created actually was interested in what was going on in my heart. And so when I was 18, I'll never forget it, and well, I hope I'll never forget it. If I start forgetting things like that, I hope the end is close. But I remember in my 1971 Volkswagen Beetle, which was just radical at the time, I prayed a simple prayer, which was, Jesus, I need you. Save me. And from that day on, I didn't know the kind of changes that would take place in my life. I didn't like Christian people generally. I definitely didn't like pastors. And so for me to be a Christian pastor is kind of like, I'm still trying to shake that off. I gotta wake up and I'm like, what am I doing? I went off to West Virginia University that fall. I so a lot of you guys are students and you're like, I'm going to UC because I want to study mechanical engineering and they have this great department. That's awesome. When I was 17, I read in Playboy magazine that West Virginia University was the number one party school. And that sold it for me. I'm going there, right? Very, very righteous, very academic. That's how I picked it. But my parents were behind it because it was a big school and it was credible and it would look good on a resume and all those things. And I went in, I was big into rock climbing and mountain biking and outdoors. And so I went in thinking, I'm going to study land management. And what my goal in life is to do is to stop developers from tearing up forest land so that we can have it to hike in. Like, let's push people back into the cities. Let's renovate what's going on in the city. That was kind of my hippie dream. And after my first 6 months, I become this believer in Jesus. These folks from Campus Crusade for Christ show up at my door and start telling me how to read the Bible and how to share my faith. And things start changing me. I'm reading my Bible. And I'm starting to tell my roommates, hey, man, this Jesus guy, he's no joke. Like, you don't want to mess with him. You should see what this guy does to people. He heals them and he changes their lives and all this wild stuff. And I get really excited. Like, I like doing this. I like telling people about Jesus. I like reading the Bible. And I had like a very basic understanding of what the scriptures are about, to the point where I started reading the book of Matthew, and I'm reading along and I get to about chapter 5, chapter 6, and Jesus says, basically, unless you're as good as the scribes or the Pharisees, you won't go to heaven. And so I'm like, all right, I've got to be good like the scribes and the Pharisees. Those are the good guys. Everybody else, those are the bad guys. So what are they doing? And I keep reading. And you get to the end of the book of Matthew. Who kills Jesus? The scribes and the Pharisees. I'm like, oh, man, I've messed this one up. I've got to fix this. Right? And so, but that allure of, all right, what is the Bible saying? How do we read this more carefully? Because you can do dangerous things with the Bible. It just began to change me. And so I wanted to study theology. I wanted to understand what this was about so I could share it with more credibility and with like more of a life-changing impact. I wanted people to meet the Jesus that I met. And so I changed my major and I studied theology for 2 years at West Virginia. And I'm studying in a very progressive environment that's very critical of anything supernatural. They're very reductionistic in their understanding of the Bible. So they don't believe that God is real. They don't believe that Jesus was God. Some of them don't even believe that he was a real person. And I'm constantly listening to this criticism of the Bible. And I'm like, man, it's changed me. I know this is real. I've watched it change other people. I see the reality of it on a daily basis. You can't tell me this is not real. And that thought like sparked something in me. All they do in this school is tell me that it's not real. They never give me a reason that's compelling to actually embrace it. Nobody showed me that positive side. And so I decided at that point, I need to get out of here. I need to go to a place that's going to nurture this faith. And so I enrolled in a school that looked amazing online. And this is still like, some of you guys are going to think this is weird. This is when the internet was still relatively new. Right? This was 1996. I don't know that I had a personal email account yet, which is kind of a bizarre thing because our culture is so replete with that. But so you had like basic information you could find online. And I found this school in Greenville, South Carolina, and it looked great. Man, it was going to embrace that Jesus was real, that he was the Son of God, that he performed miracles, that he died in the flesh and then raised again. Like, I was like, yeah, that's what I want to learn. And then I show up on campus and it's this really hyper fundamental Christian school. And I think to myself, what in the world have I gotten myself into? Like these people, like those people didn't take it seriously, but these people take it way too seriously. And I think they take themselves a little too seriously in that. And so for a couple of years, I just kind of walked through, like, I didn't know where I fit. I didn't fit with the liberal crowd. I didn't fit with the charismatic friends that I made in undergrad at West Virginia because they didn't have, like, deep, thoughtful answers. And then I go to fundamentalism, and I didn't fit in there because I really wrestled with, I think I love Jesus, but they're telling me that if I like these other things, then I love the world too much. And Jesus seemed to like these things too. So Jesus seems to like the world more than he likes God. That was kind of a problem, and I didn't fit in there either. But I love Jesus. And it wasn't until my third year there, it was second or third year there, I still felt compelled to do ministry. I still wanted to explain to people the beauties of grace and mercy and ministry. And so I found a book at a campus bookstore, not a campus, an off-campus bookstore that was off-limits. It was a Christian bookstore. So that tells you a little bit of like the fundamentalist baggage that I bring to the table. You weren't allowed to go to this particular Christian bookstore to buy these particular Christian books to talk about Jesus because they're not going to do it in the same light that our campus bookstore would. But I saw this book. It said, The Supremacy of God in Preaching. And I was like, that is a catchy title. Start thumbing through it. And I'm like, this is amazing. Somebody that is writing about Jesus, I actually resonate with him. I actually think I would fit with this guy. So I bought the book. I smuggled it back into my room. And at night when it was lights out, I would click on a flashlight and I would read this book and I would just weep because I felt like finally there's a believer out there that I could connect with. And the author of the book was John Piper, right? Who's got huge influence internationally. But he was a neo-evangelical compromiser at my school. And at the time, I think they've lightened up about it. He was off limits. John Piper was off limits. It's like, really? But he introduced me to Jonathan Edwards, and he introduced me to Charles Hodge, and he introduced me to other amazing Puritan and Christian authors that they just kind of affirm this world that Jesus is supposed to be preeminent. He's supposed to be superior to everything else. He's God, and we're supposed to worship him. And my heart just jumped within me. And so I knew from that moment on, all right, this is a time to endure. It's a time to endure. I'm going to have to finish. I'm going to have to wait. And I waited, and I waited, and I graduate, and I get an internship at a church, and I want to go to seminary. And so I get this internship at a church, and they send me to seminary. It was a great deal. And so I stayed at this church for a total of 9 years while I went to seminary, and I'm learning all this theology. And all this time, I didn't learn the one central thing that I should have learned. And I'll share that with you in just a minute. But what I was getting excited about was, like, you need to learn about Jesus. And then you need to learn all these things that I was reading about in Piper books and Edwards books and Puritan theology. And, like, all these long lists of do this, do this, do this, do this, do this. And I was kind of tripping over the main thing. And it didn't occur to me until I was getting ready to plant a church in another city. And what happened was, you have to, for the network that I'm a part of, you have to fill out applications, you have to do phone interviews, you have to get assessed. It's like going through an ordination process a second time. And I went through the process, and on the phone interview, the pastor on the other end of the phone says, "Kurt, I know you've answered this question, I know you've written it out, but let me ask you, what is the gospel?" And I'm like, "Oh yeah, I know, I'll give him a theological answer. The gospel is that God created us, that we gave him the finger, that he came and he lived the way that we were supposed to live and then died the death we should have died, raised again, and offers hope and forgiveness and new life to those that put their trust in him." Now, I said it very academically and I said it very theologically, and the guy on the other end of the phone says, "Oh, doesn't that get better every time you hear it?" And I'm like you. I'm sitting there on the phone like, "Okay, you're a little creepy. That's a weird thing to say, right?" And it's because it didn't get better for me every time. It was like, you can't even be a Christian without this. That's the basic foundational understanding of what it means to be a Christian. And then I heard that word, gospel, 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 and I kept getting called back to how stricken he was with this message of gospel. This idea that Jesus came and he lived the life that we were supposed to live and he died the death that we should have died. And he was so taken by that. And I started thinking, why am I not? And the reality hit me. I don't really believe it. I know it, but I don't really believe it. And that's what keeps me from waiting. And that's what causes me to get frustrated. And that's what keeps me from being the husband that I'm supposed to be and the daddy that I'm supposed to be. It keeps me from being the pastor that I'm supposed to be, the neighbor that I'm supposed to be, the missionary that I'm supposed to be. And all of a sudden, this idea of gospel, that Jesus did what I could not do for myself, it exploded in my face. And I said, that's what we're going to be about. We're going to be about the gospel. And that's it. It's going to shape everything that we do. And from that moment on, God has set me on a track where all I'm about is the gospel. I get really excited about it. I want to make sure that we preach it every week. And so if there's ever a sermon that gets preached where Jesus Christ is not the hero doing for you what you cannot do for yourself, we are not preaching Jesus. We are leading people away from God, because what we're telling them is, do this, try harder, do better, and God will be pleased with you. And that's not the gospel story. And the reason for many of us, the reason why it's not exciting every time we hear it, is because we don't really believe it. We think it's a nice way in, but then we've got to get busy about impressing God. And so what I want us to do is I want to call us back to, what is the gospel? How is Jesus the hero? If he's not the hero, we haven't preached the gospel. We've preached self-help. We've preached moralism. And I don't do that so that we become like the church police and we look at every church in town. We say, is Jesus your hero? Is Jesus your hero? But for us, we ask that question, why did Jesus Christ die on the cross? And when we answer that with anything other than to do for us what we couldn't do for ourselves and forgive us for what we've done, we're changing it. And a lot of us do that, don't we? Jesus died on the cross so that I can have what I want, and that's why I don't wait. Jesus died on the cross so that I could be healthy. Jesus died on the cross so I could have toys, so I could have leadership and influence. Jesus died on the cross for fill in the blank. And now what's really popular? Jesus died on the cross so that we can serve the poor. And it's like, yeah, all those things are part of it. That's not why he did it. Those are things we should be doing if we believe it. But that's not the reason he went to the cross. And even though that's sexy and it's popular and it's talked about, it's not the gospel. It's an implication of the gospel. And so what we want to do is we want to call everyone back to what is the gospel all about. And that's what we're going to express. And so we say, Missio Dei Church, we exist to be witnesses about the promise that God, by the power of his Spirit, transforms people into the image of his Son, Jesus, so that culture takes on the image of his kingdom. And what I'm going to unpack over the next 5 weeks is that we're trying and we're trying to design and we're trying to be faithful to becoming a gospel-centered, city-focused church community. That's what we want to be about. The gospel is central. It changes us. It's what unites us to Jesus. We want to seek the betterment of the city. And like I said, I'm going to unpack all this. And we're going to do it as a church community. We're going to get to know one another. We're going to pray for one another. We're going to gospel one another. We want to see you grow up, get married, have babies, show them about Jesus so that they can grow up, get married, have babies, and share with them Jesus in every aspect of life. That's the kind of community that we want to create. And so I've kind of bargained with God a little bit here. I've prayed with him. I've been praying for you guys for over almost 2 years now. Just who are the people that you have that you want me to be able to serve? And I want to say to you, I'm here. My bargain with God is if we make this move, please don't make me do it again. Right? I want to be in a place and say, my life is here. I'm sold out to that. And so as far as I know, God has sort of given me the green light for the next 40 years. And if I have longer, I'll be here longer. But for the next 40 years, I'm doing ministry in Cincinnati. And we want to plant Missio Dei kind of as in a hub of the city. That's why we're where we are. And we want to see other churches, other Missio Deis, other whatever God raises up throughout the greater Cincinnati area. We want to see them planted in Columbus and Indianapolis. We want to see stuff happen in Detroit, in Cleveland, in Pittsburgh, God forbid. Right? We want to see the gospel go out so that Pittsburgh will be a great city to the glory of God, right? Amen. We want to see that happen. And so I'm here for the next, like I said, 40 years to do that. I am I was ordained in an independent Bible church. And so that's where I have my ordination from. The way Missio operates, I'm a member of the Acts 29 Network, which is an international network of pastors. We have four pillars. I'll unpack those for you in the future. Within Acts 29, if you look at the Acts 29 Network as the NFL, I'm also part of a smaller network called the Sojourn Network. That would be like the Bengals, or maybe even the AFC, because it's going to grow, right? So it's a division under the NFL. But we're a little tighter in our affinity in how we do church. And so so Sojourn Network, Acts 29 Network, Independent Bible Church. And so the way that we kind of run the church and the government of the church is that right now I am the only ordained pastor of the church. And I have right now four other men that approve everything I do. I give them reports. So here's what I'm doing with my time. Here are the books that I'm reading. Here's what's going on with my family. Here are the breaks that I'm taking. I mean, they have like full access to me. They approve budgets, all that sort of thing. Those four guys: Kevin Jameson, pastor of the Oaks Community Church in Middletown. Brian Howard, he's one of the pastors at Sojourn Community Church in Louisville, Kentucky. And then two pastors from Missio Dei Asheville, who are the pastors down there, Brian Robbins and Derek Robinson. And so these are guys that my life is just a complete open book. So you guys don't think I just get to do whatever I want. And that's, you know, oh, we want to spend money. Let's spend money. I've got to check with them before we do things. The goal, though, is that we phase them out and we raise up elders here. And so right now we've got Justin Ramez, who's gone through the initial eldership phase. It's three phases. The first phase is application, right? And it's thorough, right? It's taken you. I met Justin in August, and we just approved his application like 2 weeks ago. So, and what it is it's a thorough, hey, here's my life, here's my theology. You've got some books you have to read on the front end. You write out references. You answer a theological questionnaire. And then we say, yep, we'll train you. And so for the next several months, we're going to be working with him. He's going to be reading books, writing papers, working through theology, getting some pastoral experience, those things he's going to do. And the final phase is ordination. And what he's going to have to do is he's going to have to stand up and defend his theology, his pastoral experience, before essentially this council of pastors. And it's not like we try to trip you up so that we can humble you and say, you don't know everything. Right? And it will be one of the best things for you. And then once he does that, we can't talk him out of being a pastor. We're convinced God has made him one. We just recognize it. We don't make him one. God does. We just put our hands on him and say, yep, this is one of the pastors. So we would like you to follow him. And then we invite him into that fold. He helps make those decisions. Some of you will be those men, right? Some of you women will be deacons that come under that. And you start laying out ministries for different things that you have hopes and dreams for. And so, I'll keep unpacking this. I don't want to say everything, because when you say everything, you say nothing. Right? And so in closing, I'll say, for all this to kind of come out, it's going to take some waiting. Right? It's going to take some patient, faithful waiting. And we're going to do it together. So we're going to be here next week. We're going to work through these values. We're going to try to hook up with fellowship, with community. We're going to try to build trust. We're going to try to build understanding. And it's going to break down. We're going to mess up. And so we're going to have Jesus as a result.